Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Japanese Studies. I'm one of your co-hosts, Sami Siddiqui. Today, I'm speaking to Professor Morgan Patelka about his wonderful new book, Reading Medieval Ruins, Urban Life and Destruction in 16th Century Japan, published by Cambridge University Press this year. Dr. Patelka is Bernard L. Herman Distinguished Professor of Japanese History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Welcome to New Books in Japanese Studies, Dr. Patelka. So our first question is always biographical. Where did you grow up and how did you become interested in Japanese history?
Thanks so much, Sami, for talking with me today. Well, I grew up in Northern California, and I've talked about this before in podcasts. I had some exposure to Japan through films. My mother managed these two movie theaters in Northern California that used to show a lot of Kurosawa films.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, I grew up watching samurai movies. I loved Mifune Toshiro. He was my favorite actor. I was a very odd child, I guess. but you know, really the truth is that it was when I went to college. I went to Oberlin College, which is a liberal arts college in Ohio. And one of the reasons I went there was they had a great Japanese studies program. So I took Japanese there. I studied history. I studied abroad at Doshisho University for my entire junior year on the Associated Kyoto program. And, you know, I don't know how or why, but I just knew that was what I wanted to do. And I threw myself into it. And I was lucky to have great teachers, people who have continued to be mentors to me all the way up to the present day. I was especially lucky to be able to return to Japan after my after graduating from college on a Watson Fellowship, which is a really unusual fellowship that gives you funding to travel for a year independently and pursue a research project, but you're not allowed to be affiliated with a university or with any institution. You have to be independent.
Oh, wow.
And so I lived with families of potters all across Japan for a year. And then I went to grad school. So that was really the kind of, the furnace that, you know, forged my interest in material culture and in ceramics.
Oh, wow. I mean, I knew some of that, you know, because I've taken obviously your courses at UNC Chapel Hill. We're both based there. I'm almost finished, but I didn't know the some of the specifics, especially the Kurosawa and the potter. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Could you talk about the genesis of this particular project? What made you want to write this book? You've written plenty of others, some of which have already featured on New Books Network.
Yeah. So when I went to graduate school studying pre-modern Japanese history, I knew I wanted to study the 16th and 17th centuries, this era of political and cultural transition in Japan. And I knew I wanted to include the study of things. I was an early advocate for material culture studies in the broader field of Japanese studies. And I was, you know, I spent my first year of graduate school basically poking at various projects, trying to figure out what was feasible, what would be interesting, what would make a contribution to the field. And I spent some time at the Freer and Sackler galleries at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., Getting to know the incredible curator for Asian ceramics there, Louise Court, who has been a mentor and friend for my entire career. And she introduced me to this site in Japan called Ichijodani that no one had written about in English, but that was emerging in the literature on Japanese ceramics as one of the best resources, because it provides, as we'll talk about, you know, a century of really detailed archaeological information. And I looked at it as a potential PhD dissertation topic. But in the end, I wanted something more narrative, something that would not be so beholden to archaeological sources at that time. And so I ended up writing my dissertation and my first book about a family of potters, the Raku family, that was founded in the same period in the 16th century, but that continued all the way up to the modern day in this generational lineage. Mm-hmm. That was actually a very hard project to complete, but but I could wrap my brain around it more easily. Whereas this one, at that time, I couldn't quite figure out how to approach it. And so after she introduced me to Ichijodani, I visited for the first time the next year, and I kept going back on repeated trips and collecting evidence, collecting excavation reports and taking pictures and talking to archaeologists there. And it took me a really long time, but eventually I figured out how I wanted to try to tackle the subject.
Great. I was wondering if you could situate us by telling the listeners a little bit about Ichijodani in the 16th century, in 16th century Japan. What are some of the important things we should know? And in doing so, I was also wondering if you could tell us why it's important to think of it as a provincial palace city as opposed to a castle town, which you make very clear in the introduction.
Yeah. So the 16th century is, I think, just one of the most interesting periods in all of Japanese history. It is probably best known to non-specialists as the Age of Warring States, this long era of civil war. That the phrase Sengoku, or Age of Warring States, is borrowed from Chinese history, where there really was a period when there were these separate nations essentially that were at war with one another. And that's not quite the case in Japan. You have provinces that are ruled by independent warlords. But it's an interesting period because it's sort of like the distilled version of the medieval. If we think about this European notion of a medieval phase in history, what's really implied by that phrase is decentralization, right? So you have a kind of central administrative structure that has broken down, or you have multiple competing central political structures. Part of Japan's medieval period, you have multiple centers of authority, or gates of power, as they're sometimes called. You have the imperial court, you have warrior authority, and you have these big Buddhist institutions that are so influential. But in the Sengoku period, after civil war, washes across the archipelago, a lot of the regional warrior leaders really retreat to their own provinces or domains, and they rule independently almost as kings. I mean, they're not kings, they're warlords, but they are beholden in a sense to no one. And I just thought that period was so interesting, and it's talked about a lot. It appears in movies and video games and, you know, anime and manga and all the rest. But we don't have a lot of literature on the Sengoku period in English. And so looking at this town of Ichijodani, which was the headquarters of one of these warlord families who ruled their own province quite independently for almost a century, was a way to get at the national story of the Age of Warring States, the Sengoku Jidai, but also the particular place, the particular regional story that this capital city represents. Now, Ichijodani is usually talked about in Japanese as a castle town. And the phrase in Japanese for this is jōkamachi. And so if you look at the kanji, at the Chinese characters, it literally is castle underneath neighborhood. Or rather, we flip it around, the neighborhoods underneath the castle, right? And that, the nuance of the Japanese phrase, unfortunately, is lost in the English translation. So, you know, these later Edo period cities that are built around castles, where the castle's up on a hill And then you have this giant urban settlement, basically, you know, flowing down from that central hub. That is not what Ichijo-Odani looks like. Ichijo-Odani is a city built in a valley, and the castle is on a distant peak, completely disconnected from the city. And instead, Ichijo-Odani is built around the residence of the Asakura, which is not a castle, it's a palace. So I, trying to understand Ichijo-Odani better, I collaborated with historians and archaeologists from Europe and the Middle East who looked at pre-modern urban settlements all over the world. And they really turned me on to this notion of a palace city. And I wanted to advocate for, you know, using different terminology. Sometimes the English translations of specialized Japanese terms don't really do the work they need to do in English. And I think castle town is fine for certain cities. Azuchi, Oda Nobunaga's castle town, great. You know, Edo starts out as a castle town, it becomes a megapolis. But for Ichijo-Odani, it doesn't cut the mustard. So it's a kind of, it's very granular, it's kind of nerdy, it's not the sort of thing that regular people are going to care about. But I think it's worth saying the language we use to translate Japanese terms matters, and we should try to get it right when we can.
No, I really enjoyed it, and it also helped to get an image. So not just like as a conceptual term for the period for specialists like yourself, which I'm not, even for me to just imagine the city, that sort of description helped to get a picture, even if you didn't have one before you. So I thought it was helpful. So on page 6, you argue that, and I quote, "The material remains in Ichijo-Odani contain a deep and profound message regarding life in late medieval Japan, which I read and interpret in stages over the course of each chapter," end quote. Could you talk a little bit about the sources you're working with, as well as the methodological approaches you found useful in reading these medieval ruins?
Yeah. So I'm a historian by training, and the core method of the historian, as you know very well, you are knee deep, hopefully at the end of your dissertation, reading the archive. It's reading documentary evidence, often in difficult scripts, difficult, historically specific language. More and more, we've learned to supplement documentary evidence with visual culture, with paintings, with a range of images, but also with material culture, with objects. And in this project, I really wanted to grapple with the rich source base of what's called historic archaeology. So archaeology is very popular in Japan. You will regularly see articles on the front page of newspapers about archaeology, which is, I just think it's remarkable. But usually that is prehistoric archaeology, archaeology about the periods in Japanese prehistory before there was a written record, the Jomon, Yayoi, and Kofun periods. But historic archaeology is when archaeologists excavate sites that are also well documented in the written primary sources. And so you can engage in this comparison. You can check what's written in the documentary record against what you find in archaeological excavations. And it allows for a much more thorough understanding of the diversity of a particular place or of a particular population than is possible with just one or the other kind of evidence. And so I wanted to do that for Ichijo-Odani. It would allow more of a social history, a kind of bottom-up approach. In the past, I've really relied on elite evidence in my research, and I ended up writing these histories of the wealthy, which was never really my intention. And through the archaeological evidence at Ichijo-Odani, we can get at daily life for a diverse population of urban residents. But, you know, the other reason to pay attention to archaeological evidence is that I think it allows us to try to think seriously and critically about the embodied experience of people who lived in the past, not just the discursive representational record, which often is aspirational, which can be manipulative or even deceptive, right? And also which is often locked into literary tropes that are possible to make sense of from the point of view of the historian, but also can be sort of distracting. when you're dealing with excavated materials from an archaeological site, you can get closer to the bodies of the people who lived in that place and the way they moved through the world. We often, as historians, I think, talk about subjectivity, right? The kind of the way historical actors imagine themselves and their place in the world. Looking at archaeological evidence allows us to also take seriously ontology, or the sensory embodied experience of being alive in the past. And I, to me, that's literally the most exciting thing I can possibly imagine, is if we can just come a step closer to know what it might have felt like to wake up in the morning in Ichijodani in 1570 and go to work, you know, and think about, how did you dress? What did you eat? Where did you go? What bridges did you walk over? What alleys did you avoid? All of that I really value. And I think it's legible. It is readable, to use the, you know, the phrase from the title, in archaeological materials in a way that it really isn't in the documentary record.
Yeah, and it was exciting for me as well, as somebody, as you know, who looks at sort of political history and is mostly in the discursive. Everything is about, you know, these elite figures who are writing these articles or journals or diaries or whatever. Yeah. So this was, it was completely opposite to what I'm working with, but fascinating for that very reason, I think. Now, I was wondering if you could read a short excerpt from the introduction and expand on it. I was also hoping you could tell us what looking at provincial communities like Ichijodani offers for our understanding of this period.
Sure. Thank you. All right. And I quote, "I have argued elsewhere that the three heroes' historiography is overly teleological, too focused on the actions of a few individuals, and insufficiently attentive to the role of early modern hagiography and historical reinvention in producing the history of the Age of Unification in a dramatic and highly mythologized fashion." So what I mean by this is that the late 16th century, the period when Ichijodani was destroyed, which I'm sure we'll talk about in more detail later, but basically when, for all intents and purposes, it was erased, that age is usually dealt with by historians in a way that is always looking towards the future, always looking at what comes next, in anticipation of the unification of Japan and the establishment of the Tokugawa shogunate in 1603, you know, the distinctive things that happened in the Tokugawa period, the relative isolation, the urbanization, the development of strong quote-unquote national culture, all of which positions Japan to become modern in the distinctive way that it does, right? So there's this sense, I think, of really ignoring whole swaths of late medieval history because historians are drawn like a moth to the flame by the actions of these heroic unifiers, these warlords who quelled the civil war and put Japan on the path to modernization. This is very clear in the English language historiography. I mean, you have early historians of Japan writing in English who just say, these were the great men who made Japan modern, you know, this kind of like, that's what they care about. That's all they care about. And as a result, by far the overwhelming majority of the population of Japan in this age is completely ignored, if not erased. On the topic of provincial communities, Ichijodani, which is now a completely, you know, rural, hard to reach site, not in an important place, was once a thriving capital city in a province that had its own distinctive story, its own distinctive identity. And that was true for much of Japanese history. People were not unified under a monolithic notion of national identity. They hadn't undergone the socialization and one might even say brainwashing of the emperor system and the experience of World War II, and then the desperate post-war attempts to create something new out of the ashes. In pre-modern Japanese provincial communities, you had local identities that were informed by the landscape, the environment, the seasonal change, the particular distinctive political history of that place. And not everything is about Kyoto. Not everything is about the capital city where the emperor lives. I love Kyoto. I'm like a huge Kyoto booster. But if we only ever look at the capital city, if we only ever look at Kyoto in the pre-modern era, Edo in the early modern era, and Tokyo in the modern period, we're really missing the majority of Japanese history. So this was a very small, humble attempt to kind of try to draw our attention back to the provincial story.
Yeah, thank you. And then later on, we'll get to the destruction at the end of the conversation as well, and get to hear what happened to actual residents. I'm also curious if you could briefly touch on the significance of Japanese language scholarship by the likes of Amino Yoshihiko and Ishii Susumu for your work, as well as your title, I believe.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yes, absolutely. So I am completely, you know, reliant on the incredible research of scholars in Japan. I mean, I certainly have looked at objects and documentary evidence in distinctive ways, and I offer my own, I think, unique arguments to the conversation. But the excavation of Ichijodani has been going on since the 1960s, and it is still ongoing. There are many archaeologists who have worked in Ichijodani and then told the story of Ichijodani to other archaeologists and historians all across Japan, to the point where it's a name everyone would know. I mean, it is it is a well-known story in modern Japan. And then you have, in particular, historians who are interested in complicating the nationalistic narrative of the Japanese past, like Amino and like Ishii, and who turned to regional sites or provincial sites like Ichijodani to emphasize the diversity of the Japanese archipelago. These two scholars put together a number of really amazing collections of scholarship that were both scholarly interventions, but also helped to popularize the stories of these regional sites. So one series that I was really moved by is called Yomigaeru Chusei, or Restoring the Medieval, which was built around archaeology and makes medieval Japan come alive without flattening it, without reducing it to people pretending they're in Kyoto, sort of. And then, you know, another series that they published was called Chusei no Fukei o Yomu, or Reading the Landscape of the Medieval. And I took that term, reading, from their title and used it in my own to honor the incredible scholarly work they and their colleagues have done. To be honest, pushing back against the Nihonjin-don style discourses about Japanese-ness that became so powerful in the 1980s and beyond. So that work was so important and influential for me. And a lot of it hasn't really shaped the field of late medieval and early modern Japanese historical studies in English as much as you might think it deserves. There's a huge literature on the provinces, the diversity of Japanese regions in the late medieval period in particular, that I just think historians can and should draw on more extensively. So I actually have as you know, Sammy, I have a really long section on the historiography of medieval urbanism and provincial urbanism, more than any of my editors liked. I was super insistent. This story really matters, and this literature is there for us to learn from. So I really want to give it credit.
Great. And I'm glad I asked that question in that case.
Thank you.
Before we dip into some of the chapters, we won't have time to go into every single one. Readers should read the book. They'll get a taste for it here. Or listeners should read it. I was wondering if you could talk about how the book is structured and how the narrative unfolds for what to expect. And then we can dip into some of the chapters later.
Sure. I mean, this was actually, for me, the biggest challenge in working on this book that I never really solved in a completely satisfying way, because I didn't want to approach the history of Ichijodani just chronologically. It is a good model for understanding the Age of Warring States or the Sengoku period, but it isn't necessarily so meaningful in the year-by-year timeline of events. And instead, I really wanted to foreground The themes. So the themes of the book are, of course, are first of all, cities, you know, urban history of the medieval period. And so I open with a chapter about the Ichijodani as a city, why I think we should call it a city and not a town, how, you know, its layout, its roads, its structure, how it's constituted. And then I wanted to delve deep into the archaeological evidence and the material culture. So we'll talk a little bit about that chapter. But I'll say that when I shared the manuscript with archaeologists, they all said, that second chapter is great because it shows how archaeology is done. You should put that first.
Oh, really? Okay.
And it was really hard to resist those, you know, very informed suggestions. But I thought, you know, the thing here that I want to use to set the stage is urban life. So I'm going to put the chapter that focuses on urban life and the layout of the city first. Then I'll get into the material culture. And then, you know, I try to have basically a chapter on the three main kind of content areas of the book. So war and the way in which warlords held onto power. And there is some narrative history in that chapter. And then religion and the kind of remnants of faith that we see in the archaeology of the city. And then culture and sociability. You know, those are topics I've talked about a lot in my previous work. The ways in which this city became a hub for all kinds of cultural activities and social rituals. Many, you know, people fleeing Kyoto to come to Ichijodani. Mm-hmm. Then I end with a chapter about the destruction of Ichijodani that really is the only fully narrative chapter in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And some readers, you know, complained, oh, this comes out of nowhere. There's not enough archaeology. Where's the stuff? But the problem is the story of the destruction of Ichijodani is fascinating.
Yeah.
And it could be a TV show, right? I mean, it's just dramatic as you like.
Incredibly
so
dramatic, yeah.
I had to give it its own chapter and tell it, linger on it, you know, and sort of savor it, even though it's very sad and tragic. And then I end all of my books, every, you know, I mean, I've only written three books, but each of those books has an epilogue in which I look at how museums display whatever the topic is that I've addressed in the book. And I like that approach. So I thought I'd do it again. And so the book ends with this examination of the kind of dilemma that it faces museums when they try to deploy Ichijodani to mean something about the past, because it's hard to do so, I think, really effectively.
No, that's great. And we'll definitely touch on the last two chapters for sure. And so moving to chapter two, which you mentioned, which is the material culture of urban life. That's the title. I was wondering if you could talk about what the rhythms of daily life were for the people living in Ichijodani in the 60 or so years between 1510 and 1573 when the destruction happens.
Yeah, I will say something I probably should have said earlier when we were talking about methodology, which is that using archaeological evidence is not easy. And one of the reasons for that is that archaeologists are scientists, and they are largely mm-hmm. writing for other scientists. So the archaeological, you know, data is presented in this very standardized format called an excavation report, which can be 50 to several hundred pages and is highly technical, very hard to learn how to read and to interpret. And, you know, they have been producing at least one, if not multiple, excavation reports every year for 60 years.
Wow.
And they're like primary source collections, basically, right? I also have been to Ichijodani to examine some objects in person, to interview archaeologists, and to see the sites, of course. And so how do you organize this stuff? Because there's massive quantities of it. It's not necessarily thematized in the reports. The reports are based on sites. And I came up with the idea of approaching it through the structure of a day in the life of, basically. There are some wonderful books for medieval Europe that try to look at, you know, what the day a day in the life of a peasant or a day in the life of a nobleman might be like. And so I tried to take that basic structure and apply it to Ichijodani, and that let me bring in, you know, data from these different reports. And also there are sometimes exhibition catalogs and things that were really helpful. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just thought, what do you do when you wake up in the morning? How do you dress? What are the different jobs like that people go to? And what are the forms of material culture that have been excavated that can help us to imagine what doing that labor would have felt like? What do people eat? You know, and then where do they go home at the end of the day? What do they do to amuse themselves? Where do they sleep? How do they sleep? Including what do the toilets look like? And, you know, where are they located? All those kinds of details. It was so fun to explore. And for me, especially, I'm a foodie. So writing about food, writing about tableware, lacquer, ceramics, you know, why are there so many porcelains from China and celadons from Korea and all of that dense, nerdy material culture detail was just so much fun to try to make sense of and to try to articulate, I hope, in a meaningfully interesting way.
Yeah, and there's some great photos in there. It just reminds me as well.
Thank you. Well, one thing I should note about that, Sammy, is that if you look at the ebook version, the photos are actually in color. Unfortunately, in the hardback version, which is the only version currently available, I hope a paperback will come out next year. They're black and white. So if you have access to a university library, you can see the color photos.
Oh, great. I think I saw them in a talk you gave, and I saw them in color there. Nice. Okay, that's good to know that you can get them in ebook form as well. So in the next chapter, which is called Late Medieval Warlords and the Agglomeration of Power, you look at the rise of the Asakura as a daimyo or warlord family in Echizen province. You argue that, and I quote, fortresses, residential palaces, and the towns and cities that grew up near them played many roles in the expanding administrations of warlords in 16th century Japan. The warlords, who in some cases had newly come to dominate their home region, such as Asakura, concentrated their resources, their activities, and their assets, financial, military, and human, in these urban centers. These distillations of the power of the Sengoku warlords represent the trend towards not unification, but rather regionalization, the creation of distinct political units at the provincial level, end quote. Now, you go into a lot of depth about the rise of Asakura, which is really helpful, actually, and how they established their authority in Echizen. But I was wondering if you could give a brief account of that for the listeners, just for those who don't know, and what you describe as this regionalization of political authority in medieval Japan.
Yeah. So this is part of my attempt to try to tell the story of the Sengoku period, which is a national story, at the same time as I'm telling this regional story about the Asakura family. Fortunately, the Asakura are a really excellent example through which to get at a whole bunch of different issues. Mm-hmm. So they started out their career not as the rulers of the province, but as vassals or retainers to the rulers of the province. So the family that ruled Echizen was called the Shiba, and the Shiba were very influential in Kyoto. Echizen is, of course, located not too far from the capital, so it was close enough to allow a lot of travel to Kyoto and a lot of exchange with the nobility and the shogunate there, but far enough away that it was more than just a suburb. And so the Asakura, when the Onin War broke out in 1467, this is the war that started the whole Sengoku period, destabilization and decentralization, they did what many vassals, you know, warrior vassals did in this age of civil war. They overthrew their betters. This is often described using a phrase called geikokujo, or the low overthrow of the high, that I talk about in the book and that others have written about. And they succeeded. They managed to betray their masters in a way that was beneficial to certain powers in Kyoto. So their new status as the rulers of Echizen was authorized from the fragments of central authority that still existed. And they then built up their power base and secured their borders. And what I really wanted to emphasize now, shifting to the regional story, is that not every warlord in the Sengoku period was a nightmarish, you know, expansionist monster who just wanted to conquer the whole country and make their name great. That that type existed. I mean, Oda Nobunaga was one of those characters, and
exactly,
there were many others. The Asakura instead seemed, and I don't want to romanticize them in any way, they were just as capable of bloody violence as any other, you know, ruling samurai family, but they were content to rule the province well and effectively and efficiently. And they maintained peaceful relationships with many of their neighbors. They engaged in diplomacy with other warlords of this era. And I think that one of the things that the whole Age of Unification narrative really gets wrong is that it assumes unification, or reunification, we should probably say, is good for everyone, right? It kind of, it presupposes the reunification of the nation state as a positive, which is kind of remarkable if you think about where that goes in Japan, but it clearly wasn't. Here is a province with this capital, this thriving capital city at its center, that is in effect going about its own business until Nobunaga comes along and says, "Join me or die." And so there is a again, regional diversity that matters, and there are these lived experiences that are not the same as the experiences of people in Kyoto that we ignore and we lose track of by erasing the distinctive histories of these regional provincial communities.
Yeah, that actually reminds me, one of the things I really enjoyed about the book was where you have times where, if you look at it from the center, what seems like disorder and chaos or even violence or whatever, from a particular regional center might be the complete opposite, where the idea of this narrative, if you just take a very centralized narrative, you actually forget that for a lot of people, very different sort of things are happening. And Ichijodani versus Kyoto is a really great example.
I think that reversal that you just talked about is something that we've paid a lot of attention to in the context of imperialism and colonialism, right? The fact that the experience of being occupied, of course, is described and, you know, understood very differently for the different populations involved. But in Japanese history, those kinds of stories are minimized because of this narrative of the monolithic experience of Japanese-ness. And we really have to push back against that, I think.
Yeah, and your book does that. You know, I think that comes through very clearly.
Awesome.
So in chapter 4, entitled The Material Foundations of Faith, which you talked about earlier, explores the religious life of Ichijodani residents in medieval Japan. You write that, and I quote, "The excavated evidence from Ichijodani and other provincial urban centers also allows us to consider religious life without focusing on the ideological appropriation of religious language by political figures such as the unifiers," end quote. I was wondering if you could explain what you meant by those words, as well as give us an account of what you learned about the religious lives of Ichijodani residents.
Sure. Well, the field of pre-modern Japanese religious studies is incredibly robust. There's so many great scholars working in Japanese and in English and other languages, and new scholarship is coming out all the time. But there is, I think, overall a tendency to privilege doctrine and visual and material culture associated with elites, or what we could think of as heirloom culture, right? So beautiful things from temples and from religious practitioners in the past that have survived to the present. Very good reasons for doing that. Mm-hmm. This is often about the canon of Japanese art history, the heritage of the nation, and even in cases where the original structures are no longer extant, trying to piece together what an amazing temple looked like in the past, or what was the decoration of Buddhist paintings like in this particular room. Those projects are wonderful. Mm-hmm. But I also think they just tend to privilege a top-down elite engagement with religion and a deployment of the sacred as a form of political ideology, right? So rulers like Nobunaga, Hideyoshi, Ieyasu may have been devout believers. I'm not doubting that. But they also knew strategically from centuries of Japanese rulers before them that one of the most effective ways of advertising your right to rule was in the religious or sacred realm.
Mm-hmm.
What about regular people?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sure, they're the passive consumers of these messages and they may admire the lacquer work on a temple that the Lord has sponsored, or on a shrine or statue commissioned by some powerful samurai. But what about their religious lives? What were their concerns? And I started, you know, as I was studying the excavated materials from Ichijodani, to think that maybe the things that were left behind when the rest of the city was burnt to the ground could be an interesting sample of what the concerns of regular people were. Mm-hmm. And so I do a survey of the entire city and what we know of the religious institutions within it. But there are two types of objects that really jump out as being, I think, particularly significant as what I call the foundations of faith, sort of the things that you can't burn away.
Yeah.
So one is this category of earthenware ceramics that are handmade by very low status artisans and used in social and religious rituals. And these are actually the most commonly excavated kind of ceramic in Japan. They're found in archaeological sites all over Japan in massive quantities. They're never displayed and never talked about because they're lacking in decoration and lacking in artistry. They're like the equivalent of the plastic cups that people drink beer out of at parties. Like, those are not going to end up in a museum, right? Because they're all the same. They're just junk. They're pooped out in a factory. So these kawarake earthenware ceramics are like the medieval version of that. A warrior might eat a piece of food or a sweet off of one of these plates and then break it on the ground to make sure that the piece is never used again, mm-hmm. to maintain ritual purity. Or you might burn a candle on it, or you might even have a little sake out of it. But the point is, it's a one-time use ritual object, and their existence allows us to map where ritual activities occurred in the city and to think about how important exchanges of food and beverage were for all kinds of ritual activities, not just among elites, but also among urban commoners. And the other category of object that survives in great numbers are these incredible stone Buddhas and stone stupas, which were commissioned as gravestones and which survived above ground. I mean, most of the archaeological evidence in Ichijodani has to be excavated through the layers of earth, but these are so durable that even though they're made in, you know, 1530, 1540, 1550, they survive all the way up to the present on the edge of the valley, back tucked among the weeds at the edge of the forest. And they have names and dates and all kinds of prayers on them. And they're just a wonderful reminder that for many residents of Ichijodani, fear of their own mortality and concern about the afterlife of their loved ones, you know, is my dear departed grandfather on his way to be reborn in a better life, or perhaps even in the Pure Land? I hope so. And this will help him on his way by adding merit to his case. I just thought they were beautiful representations of some of the core concerns, ritual and the cycle of samsara. And I'm not a religious studies scholar, so I'm sure I'm ignoring other ways of interpreting these objects, but it was really exciting to delve into those materials.
Great. And yeah, and again, there's photos of that there as well in the book. So in chapter 6, which is called Urban Destruction in Late Medieval Japan, which should give away what we'll be talking about, you know, which is the final main chapter of the book, you describe in great detail the defeat of the Asakura by Nobunaga, and importantly, its impact on the residents of Ichijodani when the city was destroyed by his troops. Could you talk about what the sources tell us about the violence inflicted upon Ichijodani, which you try to emphasize, which is, as you say, something that has been hidden by the narrative of unification?
Sure. I mean, I think Nobunaga is known and almost even celebrated for his violence. There's a funny way in which the part of the heroic legends of the three unifiers is their willingness to engage in violence on a massive scale. But I think it always is narrated with the kind of, you know, victor's point of view, from the point of view of the winners, because it's always about, yes, it was terrible that, you know, 500 people had to be beheaded after this castle was, you know, toppled. But that was also that Nobunaga could continue to reunify Japan and bring about an end to this terrible civil war. So it's always, we're going to stop violence by engaging in these inhumane, tyrannical acts of violence. And, you know, one famous story from Nobunaga's career is when he burnt the temples on Mount Hiei to punish the monks for having sheltered, actually, the Asakura, the family, and the Azai, the family that I'm talking about in this book. But the story of his destruction of Ichijodani is barely even a footnote. And so I try to look at the course of events, the exact chronology that led up to the destruction of Ichijodani, and to emphasize that the Asakura struck back against Nobunaga in significant ways. Mm-hmm. They and their allies who were opposed to his attempts to unify Japan under his own name were close at certain moments to victory. You know, I mean, it was not preordained that Nobunaga mm-hmm. would be victorious. It was contingent and contested. And that when they did finally lose and lose very dramatically, they were pursued relentlessly and the city was destroyed essentially needlessly. There was no rhyme or reason to the you know, burning of all the structures in Ichijodani and the killing of many residents. Many, it seems, fled to Fukui Echizen, the nearby previous capital of the province. But many were captured and tortured or killed. I talk about how part of the story of the age of unification that is not emphasized enough is the very intentional use of sexual violence, the trafficking in human bodies, and the exploitation of women. And I just think, I really think that stuff should be front and center in our discussions of unification, because to deny the details is to just whitewash the whole story, and to always valorize unification over every other movement and every other experience in Japanese history.
Yeah, I mean, what you described in the introduction, the teleology as well as the violence that's hidden really comes through. You know, you talk about both those things, or you complicate both those things. So I was wondering if you could read the sentences that bring your book to a close from the epilogue, which I shall also read out, The Excavated Nation on Display, and talk about what you were trying to say with those words. Sorry, this is a very long paragraph I gave you.
Okay. Learning to respect what James Bennett calls the vital materialism of objects, such as those excavated in Ichijodani, as well as the environment that shaped the city and the ontology of the people who lost their lives there, is part of the larger moral and philosophical step. We must overcome the hubris of the binaristic separation of animate and inanimate, culture from nature, and human from non-human in order to confront the challenges of anthropocentric destruction. Otherwise, we run the risk of going the way of the Asakura, with Nobunaga's predatory violence replaced now by the insatiable consumptive needs of modern human societies. The interlinked urban spaces of 16th century Japan, each of them a small universe of material life, together form a medieval multiverse that has gone ignored for too long. So,
thank you. That was very long. My apologies.
No. I mean, I wrote it.
And it was beautifully written. So
thank you. I kind of am going out on a limb here, but I'm really moved by the specific stories that we can read from the various forms of evidence from the past. And I feel that honoring those stories and listening to them is a way to counter some of the most destructive forces of the world we live in today. Mm-hmm. And to understand that the destruction of Ichijodani, as I said a moment ago, was not foreordained, mm-hmm. but was contingent and could have been averted, helps me to make sense of the urgent necessity of making changes in my life and voting and trying to make the society better to the degree that I have any agency at all, mm-hmm. to try to help avert or ameliorate the destructive processes that we see unfolding in the world around us today. Mm-hmm. I also think that what Jane Bennett is suggesting, and she's a political philosopher who's written a wonderful book about the study of things and material culture, mm-hmm. is that paying attention to the material world and to bodies and to landscapes and to the environment, listening to animals and studying trees and not abandoning humans, but looking for interrelationships as historians will make us better able to listen to the environment we live in today.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously part of the problem of our world is that we for hundreds of years haven't paid any attention to the environment and haven't listened to the world around us. So it's a stretch maybe to say that studying the diversity of life in medieval Japan can help us to push back against, you know, the terrible forces at work in the destruction of our world in the Anthropocene. But I believe it. And I you know, we'll talk about this later, but I'm turning more and more to environmental history in my work.
Oh, fascinating.
Without rejecting the study of material culture, and trying to think more about how those things are really fundamentally related.
Before I get to that question, I was wondering if I could just ask a quick follow-up. You know, because you went to, as you mentioned in the earlier question, you've been there. You're seeing how in Ichijodani, how what it looks like now, the museums there, or how it's memorialized. I think you talked about how a lot of the violence is not mentioned at all. So I was wondering if you could just tell us what it's like now, or how it's remembered, this history, or not remembered.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I want to first offer a caveat, which is that my research was conducted between, you know, basically over the last 20 years, but especially the last decade, and things are evolving in Ichijodani. And I hope that the ways in which the city and its wonderful archaeological evidence are displayed will change. But during the period of my research,
mm-hmm.
the tendency was to really strongly emphasize daily life and, you know, that kind of idea of that multiverse, of that medieval multiverse, that phrase mm-hmm. that I used in the last sentence, but not to emphasize diversity and difference, but to emphasize togetherness. It's basically framed as, come see how medieval people lived in Japan in the 16th century. You can see that more clearly in Ichijodani than anywhere else, right? And what's left out is the story of the destruction of the city and the mm-hmm. Japanese on Japanese violence of that age of yeah. unification. That seems problematic to me. And I've asked archaeologists about it, and they say, well, we're trying to be kid friendly. We're trying to tell stories that are generative and building up rather than tearing down. And I understand those explanations, but mm-hmm. I also think when an entire community is destroyed in a day, we have to pay attention and we have to ask why.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And thank you for giving me so much of your time, Dr. Patelka. But before I let you leave, could you tell us what you're working on now? You've already mentioned that it's going to be environmental history.
Yeah, so one of the things that I really became fascinated by in the course of working on this book, and especially spending time in Ichijodani, which is a valley, today a very rural valley, mm-hmm. was the constraints that the natural environment placed on urban growth. So I have maps in the book that show how you have this core part of the city built around the Asakura Palace in the center of the valley, marked on the southern and northern ends by these castle gates, as they're called. They're really city gates. But then beyond that, you have these sprawling neighborhoods that are outside of immediate Asakura control that show the mercantile and commercial activities of all these different populations, including even what appears to be essentially a Chinatown.
Okay.
And I wished, as I was writing the book, that I had spent more time thinking about the environmental context for the city's growth and for the lives of the people in the city. And so I actually at one point had a draft of a chapter about it, and I thought, I can't do this. This is going to take me many years. I'm just going to stick to the main story I'm telling here. But I'm looking now to write an environmental history of Kyoto in the late 16th and 17th centuries, called The Rebirth of Kyoto, which is really about how the reconstruction of that city after all of these civil wars invented the city that we now know, and that the environmental constraints on that rebirth produced cultural networks and pathways that also helped to make the city what it is today. So it's an attempt. A lot of environmental history today is focused on politics and the economy for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try to bring environmental history and cultural history together and understand the interrelationship between the cultural trends of this period and the environmental constraints.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Look forward to reading that when it's out and hopefully interviewing you for that too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Patelka.